Organizes for writing and communication, especially barriers. And I write to talk about work that I'm together with Thomas Superior, he's at the University of Cambridge, and my research was in New Zealand, Victoria University. So I'm going to talk about Harada Lipschitz type gravity, theory of gravity, where we follow the initial idea to use anisotropic scaling and to map it onto gravity, but then motivated from work, from previous work, we'll show you why we think it might be useful to look at a different way of mapping anisotropy onto gravity by allowing all possible terms, modifications, higher-order curvature modifications. And this basically, I will link a slow case starting from why, if you add anisotropic scaling to quantum field theory, why this can work act as a UV regulator, to then move on to effective field theories with emerging spacetime, where we have an emerging spacetime coming out from a Bose-Einstein condensate, and on top of that, you also get this anisotropic scaling. And because of this very particular form of anisotropic scaling, as it appears there, and as it appears in many other systems in nature, I will show you why we don't want to have a very elegant way of deriving by some square root of potential. We want to have a more messy curve. So I'm going to show you how to create a messy Lipschitz type gravity. So let's start with the basics. So for Lipschitz gravity, is based on anisotropic scaling. So this, as already pointed out previously, and probably all of you know by now, this is Lorentz symmetry breaking at a very fundamental level, at the level of a non-perturbative tree level. So the way this works again, you say, even so, maybe in some infrared limit, space-time is treated at equal footings. If I go to higher energies, or let's say relative in the ultraviolet fundamental theory, there is a fundamental, or the whole effective field theory might not have the symmetry, and you split space-time into space and time again. So there is a very particular way to involve this framework, and that is by only adding higher spatial derivatives to the theory. So I think originally that was motivated for this theory for gravity. One could say that is because there is a hope to avoid ghosts. Because if you add higher four-curvature terms, you also encounter ghosts. So, or you may encounter ghosts, as I've heard in the previous meeting, that is not so clear. But so there is a very particular way to suggest how this Lorentz symmetry plays into what kind of dispersion relation that should lead. And what we see here, that's the kinematic framework of Lorentz violation, as it's proposed. If you tailor expand, you assume that now you not just have the standard terms, the linear terms in the dispersion relation, you also have higher order terms. If you expand around p equals 0, which is some great expansion.
Can I just ask you a question? It's not a Taylor expansion. The linear term is not analytic in p.
Right.
You have to put a modulus sign. So I always find this very...
you can write this. And that first you make this little function of E and M, right? And then you're expanding in the sense that you try to keep these terms, right?
But it must be modulus.
Right, but plus, and then you would write.
Yeah, but I'm saying E is a vector. E is a vector. Do you literally mean the vector p in that second term? Is that a violation of rotational invariance?
Well, it is also depending on what kind of terms you add. If you have p to the 3 term, yes, you can also violate that.
But in your formula here, you haven't got a vector dotted in with the p. So the left-hand side is a scalar, but the right-hand side is a vector.
Okay, so that...
might be a mod p.
Well, either it's mod p or it's v dot p.
Or it could be rotationally violating. Like, and you can insist on rotational invariance.
Yeah, I'm just asking the question, which of those two is it? Is it
so the correct way to write is this whole form.
That one is rotation violating.
Right. Right. It is, but so I, you know, that's a little bit sloppy way of writing it. In general, I just wanted to point out you can make an expansion like that, right? And then, of course, you write you simplified to this equation, then you basically use a vector structure. But anyway, we will in this proposal only focus on series that do that are rotational in environment. So we won't break this.
So you put a modulus sign there?
Yeah, so basically we only take that, we will throw out the odd terms.
Oh, you will throw them away.
So I should have written it down more carefully, but I thought I might be a bit quicker, and I skip all this, and I just mentioned, so that is a general framework. And the hope that you have some, so Lorentz symmetry is not exact, but it is an emergent symmetry. So something very important, and which is mentioned all over again, is that there is what is called a degree of anisotropy. So if you look at, you have your space dimension and time dimension, and kappa is some placeholder for some momentum dimension, then you see that there's an anisotropy between space and time. And it's also called, say it is equal to the inter-avalistic static series, it's called the critical exponent, because depending on how you choose this degree of anisotropy, it can act as a regulator in the ultraviolet. It can modify your series in the ultraviolet such that it's renormalizable, or there's hope that it's renormalizable. So if we now, for now, let's say, start slowly, look at a little toy model, look at a scalar field, and map this anisotropy onto this model, and see if it really acts as a UV regulator. So what we take now, the kinetic part in the action. And what we see here is basically we have the time to time derivative, and that's a Laplacian to say. So you see already here this will always obey parity, right? Because it's basically Nabla to the 2 set. So this is the kind of models we're looking at here. Okay. And from this, so this is basically set equal 1 would be the standard case, standard scalar field. And now we basically extend this and say this is basically the leading order. So we can now do our power counting by just plugging in here dt is kappa to the minus z and dx is kappa to the minus 1. And you can then, because the whole thing has to have dimension 1, you can evaluate your dimension for the fields. And again, as you see, as already mentioned in our other stories, that if d equals z, the fields are dimensionless. So now, this is our kinetic term, our deformed kinetic differential operator. So this will be the leading term, and these are the sub-leading terms. And again, we do not just look at quadratic terms and nice. We also want to consider all the sub-leading terms. Also, for example, if you would do some renormalization to a calculation, you can never be sure that those lower-order terms come into your series related to additive corrections. So now this basically gives us, here we have the kinetic part, and now we add some interactions, some potential term to it. And the interactions we are considering are some polynomial interactions, very simple interactions, but going from 1 to n, so n polynomial interaction with the appropriate coupling constants. So knowing our fields, we can then evaluate our coupling constants, and we see basically we get this exponent. And we can see already that the coupling constants are have non-negative mass dimensions, so we can already see that it's the first indication that the theory might be renormalizable as long as the couplings have non-negative mass dimensions. And it can already be seen that for d equals z, the negative part here is completely gone. And even so for n goes to infinity, the whole the exponent is still positive. So now this is of course not enough. We need to look at the superficial degree of divergence has to be slightly modified, because now of course our propagator is modified. So and there's this standard result in quantum field theory, where I say if the superficial degree of divergence is negative, then the Feynman diagram is convergent. So we calculate basically so the dimensions for every loop, we get an integral like that, and we can easily evaluate the dimension. And then we also for each propagator, we get something that scales for high k, like kappa to the minus z. If we now, for a Von Feynman graph, if we now put this together, we get kappa to the d plus z l minus 2iz. So this means for the superficial degree of divergence, we can rewrite this, slightly reformulate that, and since we already know that for every loop you need at least one propagator, so you can, in some sense, forget about this term, and you see that for z equal d, this is fulfilled, and for z higher than d, of course, that's also true. So from this little toy model, we get some grasp on that really adding higher special derivatives to your theory might, it does change the behavior of the derivative. So now, how do we map this onto gravity? And there is, of course, one where the original proposal, which was called, which is basically this detailed balance where he said, I want to make the theory very elegant. And I want to have a nice description, which, of course, if you do field theory, you always get a nice elegant description. So our proposal now does not follow this lead. Instead, we are saying, is there anything around us, any system, any field theory that has, it can look a little bit like gravity, at least a little toy model, let's say quantum field theory in curved space-time, where we get such a behavior. And then maybe from that we say, we try to mimic this a little bit. So this is where what we were doing, we're looking at where the inspiration comes from, and what we looked at excitation spectrums. We looked at excitation spectrums in the Bose-Einstein condensate. Or, for example, you can also look at electromagnetic wave pipes or water surface waves, which I will come back later to. But in principle, what I'm going to explain and show you, there is a small toy model where space-time is emergent. And it's not just space-time that's emergent. It's one field theory, and we have an emergent effective field theory in an effective curved space-time. So how does it work? And since I'm showing you one model, and then I cannot, of course, say that is why gravity has to behave this way, but I want to show you one particular system that we understand extremely well, that we've studied to a very high extent, that we know that exists, and that in principle can lead to many experiments that can be done within some condensed matter lab. So what we're looking at is a system of microscopic degrees of freedom. We have a microscopic system here. It will be a bunch of bosons, fundamental, ultra-cool, ultra-cold, weakly interacting bosons. That are microscopic degrees of freedom. Then we go through a first order phase transition, and of course you all know, you form under appropriate forms, you form a so-called Bose-Einstein condensate, and that where you replace your field operator with mean fields. So you have a non-zero expectation of the first field. So we have a mean field regime where we replace the degrees of freedom, a reduction of the degrees of freedom. And then we study small excitations. And what we see that we can rewrite that excitation spectrum with introducing a metric tensor. And so what we want, we have a system that says small perturbations are dominated by a symmetric rank tensor. Then next we will see, of course, that since this thing is not just the mean field, there is something underneath it. So in all of these systems, and also in this one, Lorentz symmetry, in a sense, for the Fonon perturbations, right, is only an emergent symmetry. So, and in fact, it's not an exact symmetry, so, and you always get some anisotropic scaling, which is parabolic. So, and the degree of anisotropy is not so easy, but as I will show you, in most of the cases, it leads to an infinite series of higher order spatial derivatives. So let's go through this in detail. What we're looking at, that is basically for our fundamental theory, that is now our many-body boson system. So if you look at that, we have the Hamiltonian, here we have the kinetic term, it's a trapped gas, and here we have interactions. Notice that that's a simplification, of course. We have two-body collisions, and what we have is just to replace the actual atom potential by a scattering potential. So we We do not allow the atoms to actually form molecules or things like that. And that can, that's a valid description, because if you have a very diluted gas, so that you say it's only two particles interact at a time, so you say three-body interactions are very rare, so then, of course, with two bodies, you cannot form a molecule because of momentum conservation. So these are our parameters. And then if I say, of course, I have my standard boson commutators, and we all know that, of course, if you look at this Hamiltonian, there is an SO2 symmetry if I replace a field by a field times time of phase, e to the I phase. And when you go through first order phase transition, you break this SO2 symmetry spontaneously. And we know already that there's a theorem, the Goldstein-Boson theorem, that you will get at the Atlas acceleration. So I'll come back to that later, because it's 50, we need this later. In order, you can also generate the systems and create a mass by tampering with this symmetry. So if you look at this, so what is my Bose-Einstein condensates? So if the expectation value of my field operators are non-zero, and what I mean with that, now you can represent your condensate with what's called the density and the phase of the condensate. And what this is, you basically also have to see in some sense, so this is a mean field description, and you have little quantum perturbations around that. So that is this regime when we replace basically the bosons, the fundamental boson operators, by this mean field. And the condensate density, our macroscopic values, are the density and the phase. So now we want to see how do small excitations in the system experience a condensate. And what we see is actually if you perturb around the states, the fields, the fields and its complex valued field, what you see basically you have the mean field plus some quantum fluctuation around it. And then you can change from a non-Hermitian basis to a Hermitian basis by expressing everything with density and phase fluctuations. You can manipulate the equations of motions, and you can rewrite them in a very elegant manner. You can rewrite them as a Klein-Gordon equation, which looks now to be in a curved spacetime, and this curved spacetime is now this metric, this acoustic or induced or emergent spacetime geometry. So how can we understand that? So what I'm seeing in this metric geometry are now, because the Bose-Einstein condensate is nothing else than a superfluid. So if you look at the system, you see that you have the speed of sound and you have the background velocity. So, and you see that, of course, now you can manipulate the fluid flow, and you can actually set up specific space-time geometries. For example, if you set up a flow where the background velocity equals the speed of light, you can set up acoustic horizon. And that actually has been done in the lab, and actually we also have done that in the lab. This can be done in ordinary water, and people are now starting to investigate the possibility of setting things like that up in those ancient condensates or other superfluids. So as you can see, if you look at sound waves, let me just explain how can it be that, you know, that in any water or a superfluid that you can have a horizon. If you send signals, let's say here you are where the background velocity is at rest, and you send sound waves. Sound wave will propagate isotropically in all directions. If you now switch on some flow going in this direction, what you see that signals propagate faster this way and that way. And of course, there is a point, a horizon, where in some sense, if you generate a wave here, it will only propagate this way. So this is our supersonic region. So signals from here can never enter, leave this boundary surface. So, of course, there is a question, and that is, it is true, right, that this system seems to have some similarities with quantum fields of incoherent spacetime, but there is much more in the system. It has a molecular structure, it is definitely an effective field theory, and already at the non-perturbative level, I do expect some modifications showing up, some higher-order derivatives, and the higher derivatives you're getting are actually all of this Horowitz-Lipschitz type proposal. So now, of course, as I said, what I didn't say, when you derive this analogy, you throw something away. You are in the realms of the so-called Heidenfeld approximation. If you don't do that and you start with a Cross-Pitayevsky equation and you keep all terms, which can be formally done at that stage, if you see, basically replace your interactions between the atoms by some effective interaction. So then it's just a trick to get the thing back into the game. So there's nothing, we just really, these terms show up anyway if you do the exact analysis. So you get, instead of having just an interaction, you get some differential operator showing up here. So this U has to be replaced by a U tilde, now containing some higher spatial order derivatives acting on the background density, and so forth. And you can still write some sort of intra-differential equation, which now contains also these differential operators in here. And formally, you can still write this, but of course, this is not exactly like our wave equation. It turns out when you're in some restricted cases, if you, for example, you have a uniform background or only a time dependence, you can actually write this in a particular way. And you can write the BAC, an effective action for your effective field theory. And what you get here, this is a standard term with the speed of sound here, which takes the role of the speed of light, is your maximum propagation speed. And what you get here is a higher order correction. And this higher order correction basically shows first fingerprints of your underlying substructure. So what you get is what we call Damper quantum pressure. It's h bar over 2m. And m is the mass of the fundamental bosons. So what this is nothing else than the so-called Bugo-Yugo dispersion relation, which is linear. And then there's some sort of symmetry breaking scale, which is that divided by the speed of sound, which is somewhere here, and then there's a non-linear part. So also, so what can we say about, so this was a very simplified version, and also as I told you, in order to write this Bugo-Lyubov dispersion relation, you have to make certain assumptions, and you have to assume, for example, that the background is uniform, and so forth. So in some sense, we know already at that stage that probably what I'm getting here is much more complicated. Because if you look back, if I want to invert and I have to invert this operator, I will get an infinite expansion in these derivatives. Right? So if I cannot replace this, if I have to keep all these terms and I cannot make any simplifications, I do expect higher spatial derivatives showing up. So in general, I expect my dispersion relation to be much more messy, to have higher order terms. So what we also did, yes?
A question, what would be the order in the effective action? You also expect terms that are of higher order in time derivatives. What would be the order of the...
Here you don't have higher order time derivatives. Yeah, no.
In the full effective action, you should generate all the higher
derivatives. No, the way it works, you only get... So the correction is in this T2, right? And this T2 looks exactly like this. So, and there are only spatial derivatives in there. So, meaning what this is a measure for, if you're in a Bose-Einstein condensate, and you say there is a certain length scale, the healing length, over which, if you're larger than that, the condensate looks like a mean field. But if you go to smaller distances, spatial resolution, then you start to see that there is something going on as a substructure.
Right. Wouldn't you expect to generate higher derivative in time for the normalization procedure?
Okay, so this is something, what I am now deriving, I'm not doing any of these calculations, right? I'm starting out across the Pitayevsky equation, and then I plug everything in there, and I'm just looking at my effective position. But then I also have to say, so what is really reality here, right? If I'm looking at these things have been tested in the lab, right? This is exactly how the dispersion relation looks like. Right, it seems to follow this structure. But of course, you're right. If you do some, so these are different methods here, right? I'm just giving like following basically. We know our fundamental theory, and we just derived that. We know that there's a phase transition, we know exactly what's happening.
Excuse me, in condensed matter physics, superconductivity, crystallography. But when you go from a higher symmetry to a lower one, it goes through first or second order phase transition. Whereas here, are you going there are different symmetries.
That is misleading because, you know, you could now say, I'm getting a Lorentz symmetry in Merchant, right? But that is a Lorentz symmetry with respect to the speed of sound in the system, not with respect to the speed of light. So if you want, or if you like, you could do the following. You could start with the relativistic Poisson components. And I happen to know that people in CISA, the group with Aaron Stefano Liberati, have done that. So they started with a relativistic Poisson components. And then they derived the analogy. So in some sense, we have a biometric structure, which goes from one symmetry with respect to the speed of light to the other symmetry with respect to the speed of sound. So even so, it might, you know, this is a very, very, it's a very complicated way to think this through, but what you really get, you get a very, this Lorentz symmetry in here is with respect to the speed of sound. So in some sense, it's not connected to the fundamental theory. What you do, you carry some symmetries through. For example, why do I only get even terms in my dispersion relation? Because the symmetry was in the fundamental Hamiltonian, and some of the symmetries in the ground state carry through. So, now, can we say anything about what kind of, for example, the naturalist problem, right? What if I have, so we have the system, and I already know in order to derive it here, I have to make some assumption. Can I use a system which is already a bit more complicated, which can give me this kind of dispersion relation, where here I also get the mass. And I'm not talking about the boson mass, I'm now talking about a mass for the excitation. And can we then see if we have something like that, that this would not naturally impose some eta 1 or eta 2, which are of course highly constrained, right? There has to be a suppression mechanism independent of the Planck mass, which makes it small. So we did that, and what we looked at is a two-component Bose-Einstein component state. And we coupled them through laser transition so that we allowed, for example, the different rubidium 87 atoms to jump between two different hyperfine states. And what we got is basically we calculated the dispersion relation, and we had to do some tuning so that both excitations, we can have two condensates, take a wiglet or take a laser shiner in, and I create two excitations that will see the same metric, right? In general, this is a Finsterian structure, but you can tune it such that you have a monometric structure. And what you see actually is that if you look at the dispersion relation, it has indeed, you always get one massless mode and one massive. Because the way you break the symmetries, because you with this laser coupling, you break the SO2 symmetry. So before you had two for each condensate, two U1 symmetries, and then when you put the laser on it, they only have a symmetry, one U1 symmetry left over under simultaneous replacements. So, and this is why it's allowed you to actually generate a mass in these systems. So if you do that, and we calculated this, we actually got an eta 2, but this eta 2, so this eta 2 is proportional to the quasi-particle mass divided by the effective Planck scale, which is associated to that. But this is an independent, there's an extra suppression mechanism in there. So, and of course this is not universal, you cannot just absorb that to the speed of light, speed of sound here, sorry, because for the massless gap, this term is simply not there. So this is why you cannot just redefine your mass. So now, let's go back. This was in some sense my background and also the people I'm collaborating with, at least Matt. And now, oh, there's something missing. So now we have these systems where we know we have very many different systems, and they can space a notion of space-time of gravity or effective field theory with the gravitational field can be emerged. It also comes out with some anisotropic scaling. So the idea was, so can we now, let's say we have quantum gravity, is it really immersion and it gets this anisotropic scaling, could it not also be in this kind of messy form, right? That you get this infinite expansion, because if you say, sorry, I should have said that here, here said is equal to infinity. So, of course, you cannot do anything where you want to go to infinity, but the idea was maybe it is useful to construct a model where it just at all possible terms up to a certain point. So even so, you know, detailed balance is a very elegant way to introduce anisotropic scaling into method on probability. We propose a different one, a messy way, which looks much more like, for example, the effective field series for sound waves in a Bose-Einstein condensate.
Just had a comment to make it clear. This was already posted in my original paper, where I said I was careful to say, in general, you should allow all terms that are compatible with population preserving the geomorphism. And of course, I'm very sympathetic to this point of view. I just thought it would be very difficult to analyze a theory which has, let's say, 8 marginal coupling constants. And I was trying to look for some mechanism to cut down the number of independent couplings. So the detailed balance there is just a trick how to get a narrow class of models which might be simpler to attack. But the general story that I was saying in the paper is to allow for all terms that are compatible with engagement.
I'm sorry,
Fai. As I said, I'm sympathetic. This point of view.
Right.
But it was already in
okay. The so statement. And we followed this lead because of this, right? Because of this story. So now let's go quickly through it. Of course, now we want to method onto gravity. I don't have to say much to that. The idea is, of course, the problems, and you know, we all know very well that the gravitational coupling constant has minus 2 mass dimension. And of course, the propagator, the graviton propagator scales like that. And of course, at ever increasing number of loops, you would need requires higher counter terms in curvature. So then, as Sorabi suggested, let's take a condensed matter inspired quantum field theory and basically lead by playing the price of Lorentz invariance. And the way you do it, it's very repetitive at this stage, but again, you just use this anisotropic scaling, and you can see that the gravitational coupling constant for Z equal D becomes dimensionless. And of course, the idea that now, if for 3 spatial dimensions, Z has to be equal 3, there should be some renormalization group flow from Z equals 3 to Z. Again, the idea was also that maybe if you invoke such a propagator, instead of adding only spatial curvature terms, 3 curvature terms, higher order terms, then instead of adding higher 4 curvature terms, you would basically avoid getting these ghosts, which seems not to be the case in Europe. It's not that straightforward. So now let's just do it. Let's construct the most, that's not the most general, the most arbitrary, add all possible terms, but I have to say, we don't really do that because we don't add parity. We hold on to parity, so we only add even terms. But in principle, you could just add the missing terms to the theory, and it wouldn't much change, of course, in the Utta-Leyla because the leading term is set equal 6. So I will show step by step how we do this, how anisotropic scaling, how you map that onto gravity, how you get your modified Einstein-Hilbert action, how you then derive the equation of motion, and then I calculate a graviton propagator, and I look for the degrees of freedom. Because, you know, as you all know, for example, so in gravity, we only have a spin to excitation. There are actually condensed matter systems which have, where people now claim they have something to do with gravity. And what they actually get, they get the spin 2 particle, but of course they get also the other particles, spin 1, spin 0, and so forth. So gravity, if you want to look at it, and from a point of view of a condensed matter physics, it is a very, very special condensate, right, that only allows the spin 2 particles. So whenever we modify gravity, we have to see what are the degrees of freedom. So by adding these extra terms, as we will see, we will add an extra degree of freedom because we reduce our gauge freedom. And what you actually do, you also need to know the foliation. So you have to, if you would like to write the series in some sort of Einstein-Isa style, as by Ted Jacobson and David Mattingly, then what you would get, you would have an additional scalar field sticking in, and the gradient of the scalar field would basically point in the direction. So you can, in principle, add a dynamical foliation, as you will see, but you cannot avoid sticking in an extra degree of freedom. So how do we do that? Of course, and I think this was a very nice idea, very fascinating idea. You start with, okay, I only want to add higher curvature terms, so I choose the ADM formalism. I split space-time and foliate into space-like non-interacting slices, that is foliation. And so I use the Einstein-Hilbert formulation of gravity, so I have the kinetic terms here and here the potential terms. And if I look at the kinetic terms, now, since we do break Lorentz invariants, right, we should also allow, there's no reason, so this is the standard Einstein-Hilbert plus this little Lorentz symmetry breaking term. That is also there in the original proposal, but it's kind of put together as a constant here, so it's not one. So we consider this, put this part separately. But so this is generic for all Ravel Lifshitz-Stein type series, because now we cannot exclude those. But of course, this does only include second-order time derivative. So that is basically the extrinsic curvature, and here basically would only add highest spatial curvature terms at the slice, spatial slice. So the way to start is you take your space-time geometry and you put, when you do the dimension counting, power counting, then what you actually put this anisotropy in. So it's exactly the way, in some sense, as we've done it with the starter, with this little toy model which I discussed at the beginning. So we can see already, I should say, so you can evaluate from this product, you can find the dimensionality for the shift vectors. Oh, I should say that actually, so of course it's over now, we have the left and the shift. So, and here this is in the induced metric on the spatial slides. Right. So you do your power counting straightforwardly, it's not difficult, and then you can evaluate what the dimension is of the gravitational coupling constant, and it is indeed coupled to the d minus a. So from the kinetic term, we've now chosen that d equal to z is exactly analog to the scalar field, and now we look at the potential terms. We look at that, so we know basically, we know what the volume element is, and then we find out that the potential term has to be of coupled to the 6. So the way it's not straight. So basically we can, from that we can evaluate what kind of higher order derivatives, spatial derivative or higher order curvature terms can I add to the series. So within this framework, the induced metric is dimensionless. So, and therefore we can, some limit will have second order spatial derivatives. So then you can construct all possible terms, since every Riemann tensor has a kappa 2, right? It has second order spatial derivatives, and then induced metric is dimensionless. It's of order kappa 2. And you can then add all the higher spatial curvature terms, which possible terms. And then because it's three dimensional, the Riemann tensor vanishes, and then you can decompose the Riemann tensor and the Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar. So this simplifies a little. And all the difference is with this detailed balance, there's a kappa to the 6 term there, and it does break parity. So I generally want to not exclude that, but that's also different. There's a difference in machine. So now we're using some integration by parts and discarding surface terms and so on, some identities, Bianchi identities, and we reduce the possible terms, all the possible terms, to five independent terms, lower order five independent terms at kappa to the 6. So these are our leading terms, all the leading terms that has to be included into the theory. And then we have all the lower order terms as well. So when you write this down, now we have constructed our action, our effective action, and what we see now, of course, here we have a Lorentz symmetry breaking term, and here is our potential, which now is with appropriate coupling constants, and this is to make the dimensionality right. We want to have dimensionless coupling constants, so we write it down this way. And you can split it up into standard Einstein-Hilbert and the Lorentz symmetry breaking terms, if you like. So this would be the standard Einstein-Hilbert, and that will be the correction. And that comes from the kinetic term. So, now, of course, you can do some phenomenology. Also, one should be careful because we're looking at bare coupling constants. So the statement I'm making now, and also I'm saying this because we pointed this out in the paper, I still would like to say that, of course, one has to see what happens to your couplings when it goes through some renormalization of calculation. But one of the, let's say, advantages, actually, at that level is that you can get, you have more flexibility to basically choose your coupling constants, right? So we can identify this G Newton with that constant, and we can choose a cosmological constant this way, right? And there's this G naught showing in. So you have some independent way to tune them. And in the original proposal, if you have a non-zero Newton constant, that requires a non-zero cosmological constant of the wrong sign. But I'd like to say that these are the bare coupling constant, and that is not, of course, sufficient.
Right. I just want to point out again that I somewhat disagree with what it says in the purple box, because all the terms that you had on the previous transparency, they were in the original paper. I was just saying there are too many terms. If you really want to do a practical calculation, can we see a mechanism to eliminate most of them? Let's try and look at the narrow class of detailed balance models. But the original proposal is to actually include all the terms, including breaking detailed balance explicitly, but it was also done in that book. So, again, I agree with what you were saying, but much of it was already mentioned explicitly in that paper.
So, now we write our equation of motions, and then, of course, we have two constraint equations and the dynamical equation, and we already have the lapse, the shift, and the use metric, right? So we can derive this. It's three equations, the constraint equation and the dynamical equation. And I just was thought maybe it might be nice to see at every stage how much we actually differ from the standard Einstein Hilbert. So we do that, and if we look at the Hamiltonian constraint, and there is something very strange going on, because the Hamiltonian constraint, that's actually not right, I should not say. So first let me say something. So we're choosing, in order to reduce our terms, we've done something which one shouldn't do. We reduced the lapse, which was a function of time and space, choosing that to be a function of time only, and that's called the projectable case. And if you do that, you're paying a price. And that is that the Hamiltonian constraint now has its integral form, so it becomes non-local. So first of all, so that is a huge difference, right? And the other thing is, of course, here you have your extra kinetic, in the kinetic energy, you have this this one Lorentz symmetry breaking term, you have this more complicated potential, but you also have an integral form. So if you then calculate the supermomentum constraint, so what is interesting is the supermomentum constraint is not affected by the potential term, so it's generic to all models. And all you add is this one kinetic term to the series. So, and then the dynamical equations, if you vary with respect to the induced metric, so here is your set of equations. Notice that, of course, now we don't have spatial derivatives of the lapse in there because we are in the projectable limit. So but what we get is, it looks also, it still looks very nice and neat. This term here contains all the spatial the potential terms in there. And what we see is actually, you cannot read it, but I just want to convince you there are two terms. And if you do this, something, so you can write it as some sort of expansion in a way. So that would be our equation of motion. Okay? So very complicated, but now what we do, the first thing one would usually do is look at the degrees of freedom. I give you two coordinates matter system and say, are they similar? The first thing one would do is to look at its excitation. So that's what we're now going to do. We look at, so we linearize all these three equations, the constraint equation and the dynamical equation, and then we use all of our gauge fixing. We're now having a reduced gauge fixing because we work in this preferred foliation, and we try to gauge away as many degrees of freedom as possible and see what's happening. So where do we perturb around? And next, we perturb around flat space-time. So we perturb around Minkowski space-time in the standard manner. And then what we do, we get a linearized Hamiltonian constraint and a supermomentum constraint and linearized dynamic ball equation, so they look much nicer already. And what we will see, we can gauge fix this away later. So what we're using, the synchronous gauge, when we gauge away perturbations in the lapse and in the shift. And then we have also, we use the rest of, we basically follow the procedure as in the original paper, right? we use some of the gauge ring can be used. Of course, if I have an equation for a spin two particle, I take the trace and have this equation for a scalar. And then, of course, I can use some of my gauge freedom to separate those two equations. So we do all this, and notice, please, that here, of course, that is where all the problems lie. This wouldn't be this way, right? If we would also have, so this is our reduced, because if we now have a coordinate transformation, it has to obey, it has to stay within the formation. And that reduces the gauge field, the coordinate freedom. Mm-hmm. And this actually, as we will see, has consequences. So because of that, in our reduced gauge freedom, I'm now looking at the case psi not equaling zero. Because if psi is equal zero, psi is, remember, the one additional Lorentz symmetry breaking term in the kinetic part. So if psi is not equal zero, then I get this mode for the spin zero scalar graviton and the spin two tensor graviton, and I cannot gauge it away. So whatever, let's first say what are the few successes. Indeed, we get this dispersion relation, a transfer volume of dispersion relation, with, so basically it should be three here, right? So we get the propagator as original pulse, but we also have the spin zero scalar graviton here, and I think you will hear a lot of talks about that. So if we now look at the case, so we can calculate our propagation speed for the spin zero particle, and we can write it down in this way, right? It's easy to read off in the dispersion relation, right? It's a, what I'm looking at is this part. It's a linear part that would be the emergent propagation speed. And if I'm looking at that, then what I see, there are different cases, right? First, psi. So in the original proposal, it's called lambda. And of course, there's a mapping from psi onto lambda because it depends, as you see, on the kinetic term. So this kind of behavior, it will also show up in any relativistic stratified theory, because the psi reflects the breaking in the kinetic term, the Lorentz symmetry breaking in the kinetic term, which is not dependent on the kind of exactly what kind of potential you actually see. So what we find, of course, you can just look at it and say, okay, if this is c squared, if that is negative, right, I have an elliptic equation, it's non-propagating, it's just exponentially growing. So what this means, if you have a quantum field theory and you have some exponential growing modes, it means it basically flows up. It's unstable. So, and then there is a region of propagation in here where this mode is there. But I think that, so there is a lot of work has been done by other people, and some people show that lambda equal 1 might be the only hope where you can get rid of this scalar mode, right? But at the same time, they look at the linear order, but then at the cubic order or so, it actually blows up. So there's a new paper out by Kiyama and Aurora, and I think that's worth reading. And then but that is basically, sorry, this should be up here, so for the projectable case. So it seems to me that there are a lot of problems in here that in this region also the propagating spin zero graviton, it seems like FB is a ghost. So in some sense, I would say actually our case, the projectable case, one, I'm not 100% certain, but I think there's a very high possibility that the projectable case might be ruled out. But I think this, will be discussed a lot, for example, also about the presentation by Diego Blas and Robert Brandenberger. So I think I should leave this to discussion, open for discussion. And come to my last slide. So what I think, that despite I really like this proposal, and I think it's a great idea, because for me there are really a lot of common matter ideas and concepts which we see all around us, which show up, which in Haravalucci's gravity have been mapped onto gravity. So I think this is a very nice idea, and if gravity is emergent, if there is some fundamental theory which has nothing to do with gravity, has some microscopic structure, whatever, and you get an effective field theory, it is not so clear why this effective field theory should be something very nice, very neat, should be something very elegant. Maybe we get gravity plus some extra terms, and it seems to me that it's very worthwhile exploring this, but there are also a lot of things that worries us, the excitations, the spin zero mode, which is not observed, because if it would be out there, we would see it by binary pulses, because it would couple to the mono and dipole moment. and then the energy loss from such a system would be larger. So it seems not to be their observations, and it causes us a lot of trouble in Lichtwitz high-type gravity. Then, of course, the UV behavior. One, I think, well, there are also some renormalization group calculations are necessary to really see if this is a fixed point, for example, or to see if you've done a renormalization group calculation, how the theory really looks like in the infrared. Then, of course, the detail balance, I made this picture, I hope I don't offend anybody, but there was this paper about exact solutions. And there is a problem if you really keep hold on to a detail balance exactly, and not just within the potential term, also relative to the kinetic term, that you, in some sense, you have problems to recover all exact solutions. So slight relaxing this condition seems to me would avoid the problem with the exact solution, because this is not just some quantum matter system. We have some GR solutions there, which we should try to recover in the system. So of course, there are all these worries on matters. How do we add matter to the theory? So exact solutions, I said this already, like, are we getting all the exact solutions and the projectability? I think that it's easy initially to get around that by just relaxing that, but if you would construct, you would follow our proposal or the original proposal, you would get more terms because you get some boundary terms coming up, right? So all you're doing, you make it more messy. But so it's more workload, but this can be somehow, I think, one can get by there. So, thank you.
Question.
That icon next to projectability, is that somebody holding a briefcase with a hat on?
Yeah, that means a lot of work has to be done. Someone goes to work. It's not a briefcase.
Thank you.
One question on the previous transparency, when you were saying that the spectrum near the flat space may rule out the projectable case, doesn't that mean that it rules out being able perhaps to make a reasonable expansion around flat space, but the flat space might not
right.
be the ground space?
Actually, it's a very good point, yes. So Robert Brown will say, and I talk about this, and there was also work by Roy Martins and Arskin, so it, you know, what is the right background to perturbate. And I really agree with you, right? That's not such a trivial question.
But
so maybe I should not have made such a strong statement it is to rule out, but at least as the way I suggested it and the background I linearized around it, there are some problems.
Right. Because, for example, in the Higgs mechanism, if you linearize the spectrum near the zero depth of a potential which has a double well form, then of course
right.
you predict that this is an unstable system, but you're just expanding in the wrong solution.
No, this is a very good point. Yes.
Other questions? If not, let's thank Silke again.